The war in Iraq isn't over. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. 15 years ago, the U.S. declared victory in the battle for Baghdad, and yet the war in Iraq continues. A veteran journalist says it offers a big lesson for American leaders today.
Don't invade a foreign country unless really, really have to. Because no matter how careful you think you are going to kill a tremendous number of civilians. And there's no forgiveness for that.
Plus, working to help Canadian women release from prison.
They're coming out with, you know, very few belongings in a clear plastic bag and a bus ticket back to where they were arrested from, right?
And she knows because she was one of them. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could make it here today. All in all, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg spent 10 hours getting grilled by lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week. And what does Congress have to show for all that questioning? Well, not much, I'd say. Many of the questions weren't that sharp, and Zuckerberg seemed to have very few satisfactory answers. One concrete thing that did come out of his testimony was a promise to respond to Facebook problems outside the U.S., including how the platform moderates hate speech. That's been an issue in Myanmar. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat from Vermont, questioned Zuckerberg on this. Behind Leahy was a display with screenshots of recent Facebook posts calling for the death of a Muslim journalist.
Now that threat went straight through your detection systems. It spread very quickly. And then it took attempt after attempt after attempt and the involvement of civil society groups to get you to remove it. Why couldn't it be removed within 24 hours?
Senator, what's happening in Myanmar is a terrible tragedy, and we need to do more.
We all agree with that.
Okay.
But how can you dedicate, and will you dedicate, the resources to make sure such hate speech is taken down within 24 hours?
Yes, we're working on this.
We really welcome the 24-hour commitment because that's the first time that they're really attempting to set a target. I think there still remains tons to be done.
That's Victoire Rio. She's a social media analyst based in Yangon, Myanmar. And she spoke with my colleague Lydia Emanalidu, who joins me now. So how big a problem is this in Myanmar, Lydia?
It's a really big problem in Myanmar and other countries as well. So you might remember earlier this week we spoke with BuzzFeed's Asia correspondent who told us about how a very similar scenario is playing out in Sri Lanka, where you have extremists posting content that eventually leads to violence. And that's what we're seeing in Myanmar as well. In fact, the UN's Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar, just last month they said that social media sites and Facebook in particular played a, quote, determining role in spreading misinformation and hate speech that led to violence.
And of course, in Myanmar, we're looking at nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslim refugees fleeing into Bangladesh, escaping a military crackdown, escaping hate. So what do these groups, like the people Victoire Rio is associated with in Myanmar, digital activists, what do they want to see?
So as you heard Rio say earlier, she and the digital rights groups that she's working with on the ground in Myanmar are very pleased that Mark Zuckerberg made this commitment to respond to flagged hate speech within 24 hours. But they say there is a lot more that the company can do.
I think maybe the first thing would be to start setting up a dedicated country team. So at this point, there is no one from Facebook in Myanmar. So it's really important that they be a team in Myanmar that speaks the local language, understand the context, and can serve as an interface for the local community here.
I should note that I reached out to Facebook to confirm whether they have any staff on the ground in Myanmar and to ask how many Burmese language content moderators they have on their staff. They haven't gotten back to me. But Mark Zuckerberg did say during the hearings this week that the company will hire dozens more Burmese content reviewers and that they're working with civil society groups on the ground to kick repeat offenders off the platform. But to do that on a larger scale, not just in Myanmar, but also in all the other places around the world that are struggling with this, Zuckerberg said they're going to have to automate the system. And to do that on scale, they're going to have to use artificial intelligence tools.
I mean, given that self-moderation hasn't worked out so well in countries like Myanmar, is automating the process realistic?
Right. Mark Zuckerberg himself admitted that, you know, when you're dealing with linguistic and cultural nuances, artificial intelligence technology is not quite there yet. He did say that he's optimistic that technology will be there within the next 5 to 10 years. But people who study this stuff aren't quite so optimistic. I spoke with Robin Kaplan, who's with the Data and Society Research Institute.
Hate speech changes incredibly quickly. It's culturally very specific. It's localized. It's linguistically very specific. And so developing machine learning programs or automation to identify every single instance of hate speech is an incredibly large task.
And so in the meantime, people on the ground, people like Rio, who have been so incredibly frustrated, you know, they say that for years they've been asking Facebook to respond more promptly to flagged content. They can't wait 5 to 10 years for Facebook to come up with this technology. And so they want to see the company taking steps immediately because, as Rio said, human lives are at stake.
The World's Lydia Manalidou, thanks for kicking things off today.
Thank you.
After all the news about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica recently about how our data is not really private, here's a question for all of us. Does the internet make our lives better or worse? The nonprofit Mozilla Foundation wanted an answer too. They collected data and stories from around the globe and released an internet health report this week. Mark Sermon is executive director of the Mozilla Foundation, and I wanted to hear first what he means by internet health.
Well, really, it's about the internet being a big ecosystem. So think about the health of the planet. Really, we live in this digital environment right now that's made up of technology for sure, but also people and money and ideas. And so it's really, is that digital environment healthy and good for us as humanity?
So what are the major issues you cover? I mean, what do you look at? What are the matrices?
Well, one of the reasons we kind of started using this term internet health is because there's lots of factors in the ecosystem. One of the ones that's in the news right now is privacy and is data secure, the sort of centralization of power in a few small tech companies, which is really counter to the whole decentralized vision that the internet was founded on. And then, of course, there's human issues around digital inclusion and digital literacy. And is the internet something welcoming and that actually unlocks opportunity for all of us?
Yeah. So what's the headline? Is the internet healthy?
You know, people in the media hate this headline, which is, it's both healthy and unhealthy. I mean, on the surface, this week, but certainly even in the last year, many of the things we care about the most are unhealthy. I mean, you had the five big tech companies, and it's a real concern, the amount of consolidation of power, and certainly the amount of data being collected is at the forefront. And those are unhealthy things. But the flip side, you know, you've got more and more people getting online. I think we're now at about half of the world that will be online this year, and that continues to grow. And so more people have access. Many things are actually improving in terms of security. So the amount of encryption, whether that's in WhatsApp or in regular web pages, is going up. So many things we want to have happen on the internet, more access, more security, are actually going well.
So you had a prototype of this health report of the internet in 2016. What changes have you noticed in the past 2 years?
What's happened, I guess, is two things. We've gone deeper in the issues. About 200 people who have helped contribute to the report, like a big open source project like Wikipedia. And it's allowed us to really look at the internet from a global perspective. It's not all what happens in Palo Alto or Silicon Valley. So that's a change in what's in the report. Changes in the world, really, and I think of this as a factor of a healthier internet, people are more familiar with the issues. There's just no question. The last 2 years, we've seen people become more concerned about their data. We've seen politicians actually start to think about these topics. And it's not surprising given some of the events in the world. My view is that Facebook and Cambridge Analytica are the tip of the iceberg.
So how would you start to turn things around where the business model is driven more by ethics than by this quid pro quo of people's data for advertising revenue?
Well, that's where I think the debate is immature and way too binary. You're kind of getting this no data or all the data conversation. And we really talk about lean data. Obviously, we collect some data through Firefox, but we collect as little as we can. We keep it for as short a time as possible, and we make it transparent to users where they're making choices when we're asking for their data. That's where we should be going. You know, it's not that different than clean energy versus dirty energy. And in many ways, you know, Cambridge Analytica is sort of like a Fukushima of data where it's a big blip, right? We notice that something bad happened. But then actually that blip should be pointing us to there are a bigger set of questions of how do we want energy to be produced? And here is a question of how do we want the deal around data to work?
Yeah. So who is the dirty coal in this internet business? Like, who's going to push back on that?
Well, those are two questions. Their dirty coal is clearly the biggest social media and search companies. You know, they collect as much data as possible. They aggregate it. They collect it outside of places you expect it. I mean, one of the things we're trying to push Facebook on is don't collect data outside of Facebook all across the web, which they do. It's a core part of what they do, without giving users a chance to opt in.
I just think, you know, Mark Zuckerberg feels like such a lightning rod for all of this. How much do you worry that Zuckerberg is off Capitol Hill now, the testimony's over, and we're all just going to go back to entertaining ourselves to death?
I don't think we're going to just go back to entertaining ourselves to death. There's enough people now who are talking about this that are going to keep this going. We did a poll earlier this year and then the year before on privacy. It's basically both in Germany and the US, a 10% increase, I think from 56 to 65 of people's concern about privacy. And, you know, when you have these tipping points, whether it's people finding out that Nike is making their shoes in sweatshops or a nuclear disaster, a lot of people will tune out when the shock is over, but it usually does spark sustained action. There is a growing movement of users around the world who are going to demand better, and I don't think that's going to go away.
Mark Sermon, the executive director of the Mozilla Foundation, telling us about the foundation's first full Internet Health Report. Thanks very much, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hungary's far-right prime minister won a third term in office this week. Viktor Orbán ran for re-election on a strongly anti-immigrant platform. And then yesterday, Hungary's main opposition daily newspaper, Magyar Nemzet, announced it's shutting down. Flora Garamvergi worked at Magyar Nemzet, and she joins us from Budapest. What was Magyar Nemzet, and why did it close down, Flora?
It was the last printed opposition daily newspaper in Hungary. So I think in any country, when an objective media outlet closes its doors, it doesn't matter if it's left-wing or right-wing, it's a tragedy.
Yeah, and why did it close down? Financial situation?
Well, yes, you could say that. In light of the government's aggressive advertising campaigns, including threatening advertisers not to advertise in newspapers that dare to criticize the government, the Magyar Nemzet had no choice but to close down before going bankrupt.
So what remains in Hungary right now in terms of printed media is only outlets run by the government?
Most of them. It's not directly run by the government. It's run by a person who is a good friend of the prime minister. He was a gas fitter before, actually, and he became a millionaire. His net worth about like $500 million. So he owns like 120 companies, including media companies in Hungary.
So he's a media maven.
Yes, you could say that.
What will the journalists who worked at Magyar Nemzet do now? What are you doing?
Looking for a job.
What was it like for you working on those final editions of the paper?
I feel extremely honored that I could be a part of it. I will really forever cherish the ethics of journalism I learned there from my colleagues at the Foreign Affairs Desk and at the whole newspaper. They were true professionals, and I feel really lucky that I had the chance to work with them.
So, Prime Minister Viktor Orbán now entering his third term in office. Why do you think his policies have been so appealing to Hungarian voters?
Yeah, it goes back to the media situation because the government controls most of the media in Hungary. So people have been made to consume racist, xenophobic, anti-immigration propaganda all over the news. The government is and was trying to make people believe that millions of Muslim refugees are trying to come to Hungary and will push their religion and culture aggressively to Hungarian people. Officials in Hungary talk of the risk of terrorism and about Islamic invasion. And the whole issue started with billboards in 2015 that carried three messages that sounded like, if you come to Hungary, you cannot take away Hungarians' jobs. And if you come to Hungary, you have to obey our laws. If you come to Hungary, you have to respect our culture. And I think it's a really clear and extremely upsetting message. The whole campaign blaze of people's fears.
Journalist Flora Garamvergi, who used to work at Magyar Nemzet, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
15 years on, lessons from the Iraq War. That's coming up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. In the official history, the Battle of Baghdad ended 15 years ago today, with U.S. soldiers and Marines establishing loose control of the Iraqi capital just 25 days after the invasion began. Of course, the fighting in Iraq was far from over, and the consequences of the invasion are still with us today. We've looked at different aspects of that anniversary this week, and we're going to spend the next few minutes recalling those first weeks of the war as seen through the eyes of two American journalists who were there. Ellen Nickmeyer was reporting for the Associated Press, still is today. Peter Moss was writing for the New York Times Magazine in 2003 and is currently senior editor for The Intercept. Thanks for being with us, Peter and Ellen. Peter, first off, listeners may have seen you tweet out your memories of the invasion in real time, day by day, over the past few weeks. It was pretty immersive. What prompted you to do that, like on this particular anniversary?
I think frustration prompted me to do it. I woke up in the morning and I think I read on Twitter somewhere that it was the 15th anniversary of the start of the invasion of Iraq. And even I hadn't realized that, oh my gosh, this was the day, this is the 15th anniversary. You know, do we have a duty to try to remind people? And if we do, how do we do it? And, you know, I could have quickly written a story, I suppose, but I just thought, I'll just do it on Twitter. I had a lot of photos and other things on my laptop from that time. And so I just started kind of tweeting about that first day of the invasion 15 years ago.
Neither of you were embedded, meaning you went into the war zone without the protection and control of U.S. forces. What was it like crossing from Kuwait into a war zone, Ellen, under those circumstances?
This war more than any, the Iraq war more than any I'd covered before, there was a lot of insistence on the military was going to control things and the U.S. government was going to control things. And some of my colleagues told me there was no way I would be able to get in Iraq if I wasn't embedded, you know, that this was like a different kind of modern war and there wouldn't be people just roaming around. And for us, we staged on the Kuwait border and we rolled across without problem in our own vehicles in that first half hour. We were unilaterals. We came to depend on the kind of the protection of some Marines we joined up with to travel with. I mean, they were really essential to our safety. So that was great to have. But that was a choice that we made and they made to allow us to travel alongside of them. And I do think that traveling as what they call the unilateral instead of an embedded reporter, you got to see a lot more and have some interaction with Iraqis as well.
Right. And even though you weren't embedded, presumably they gave you a little security too.
Oh, well, yeah, that was, I mean, you know, and Ellen can probably speak to that, you know, as well or better than I can. But without, we had tried, Ellen, me, and the about a dozen other unilateral journalists who managed to get over the border. And that was pretty much the total number of unilateral journalists who were able to get over the border in the first day before it was really sealed. We had tried for like 2 or 3 days, and Ellen, I forget how many days it was, to kind of wander around on our own. And, you know, we nearly got killed one day where we just drove towards Basra because the soldiers told us, oh yes, the road's open, it's secure, but it wasn't, and we were driving towards Iraqi front lines. And we just realized that, like, we had to follow just one battalion, because even hopping from one convoy to the other, each time we approached an American convoy, their weapons would be aimed at us, because we were just these SUVs coming from nowhere, and they had no idea who we were. So we had to just stay with one battalion.
Ultimately, this is a story about Iraqis, not Americans. And Ellen, when we asked you to join us today, you shared links to two stories that you wrote 15 years ago. And what's striking are your reports of U.S. Marines killing Iraqi civilians. Why is that something you wanted to highlight?
What happened when, on the first day and the first hours that the Marines crossed into Baghdad, remains kind of one of the most striking episodes of all my reporting of wars. And it was a troubling day. And what was happening, my understanding of what was happening above our level was there were rules of engagement that basically, on the part of the U.S., that basically said, we're worried about suicide attacks, so, you know, give warning shots, and if people keep coming, go ahead and shoot them. And that's what happened. A lot of civilians who
most likely were not aware that the Marines were already in Baghdad.
Peter Moss, what lessons could or should be learned from the invasion you witnessed 15 years ago?
It would take me a few hours to begin to answer that question. I think, you know, one of the major lessons is don't invade a foreign country unless you really, really have to. Because no matter how careful you think you are going to kill a tremendous number of civilians. And there's no forgiveness for that.
What lessons do you come away with, Ellen, when you think about those first days of the invasion in Iraq?
I mean, the overriding one has to deal with civilian killings. And it's something that's kind of guided all my reportings of war. And, you know, whether it's a land war or airstrikes, people with the Red Cross who know the Geneva Convention and protocols, they tell me that, you know, combatants to protect themselves cannot transfer all the risk to civilians.
You're kind of talking about the shoot first, ask questions later idea.
Right. I mean, the idea that combatants are not allowed to do everything they possibly can to protect themselves under the rules of war is my understanding. If it's going to, you know, just in the name of protecting themselves, it endangers or puts all the risk on civilians of being hurt.
Peter, I think it's your most recent tweet ends with the line, 15 years later in Iraq, the war started by America continues. As you kind of have been thinking about this 15th anniversary these past few weeks, how many people do you encounter feel like or even know that this war is in effect continuing?
None.
Really? Not a one?
People have responded to my tweets and said, you know, this is interesting. Thank you for doing this. But I haven't, you know, heard anything outside of that. Nobody, you know, in my world is, my world's a world of journalism, is talking about Iraq and, you know, how can we mark this anniversary. People outside of journalism aren't coming to me. I don't hear any conversations on the street, and I don't imagine you do either. People saying, you know, 15 years ago we started this war and it's still going on. It's being forgotten right now. And that's very disappointing. And, you know, I kind of have found that, you know, my work of covering the Iraq War isn't over. that telling the story once when it happens is just maybe the beginning of what journalists need to do, because there's so much going on and we're so prone to forgetting that we have to keep trying and finding new ways to write about these old things, because they're not old to most people. They're forgotten, not even known.
Journalist Peter Moss and Ellen Nickmeyer were witnesses to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq 15 years ago. Thanks very much for helping us remember it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Greyhounds at a racetrack in Tijuana, Mexico, have it rough. Many are mistreated, abandoned, or worse.
These are such magnificent animals. How can you sit on the sidelines and do nothing?
A cross-border greyhound rescue, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Going in, being in, getting out. That's a cycle of incarceration, and it's what our Across Women's Lives team has been investigating. The rate of women going into prison in the U.S. is rising. It's a trend that's happening around the globe. But once they get out, then what? This week, we've been looking at what it takes to stay out of prison. Andrea Crossan heads our Across Women's Lives project and joins me now. It's multiple challenges facing women when it comes to staying out, isn't it?
There are so many things that are stacked against women when they're coming out of the doors of a prison. And there is this kind of this window of time where it's so crucial that they get support because they are the most vulnerable. What we found in our reporting is that it's really common for women to be going into prison specifically for addiction issues. So whether that be drug dealing, whether that be shoplifting to support a habit. So what you also have to realize is that when they're coming out, they still have to deal with the addiction.
Mm. Isn't this a problem, though, for both men and women?
Yes and no. Yes, there are men who are facing a lot of these similar challenges. But what's different about women is that for so many of them, the living environment that they had before they went into prison, they call it an insecure environment. What do you do with these women who they're coming out the door and their option is either to move back in with the person who was abusive, somebody they potentially did drugs with, somebody they potentially committed crimes with, or be homeless?
So the story we're going to hear today is you met a woman who's working to help other women during this challenging period.
Yeah, I met this woman, Mo Korchinski. Let me say right off the bat that Mo is a tough cookie. She is an incredible, incredible force of nature. And I spent a day driving around Vancouver, British Columbia, which is my hometown. And Mo's what's called a peer mentor. And that's just kind of a fancy way of saying that she's been there, done that. At a very low point in Mo's life, she was a regular user of cocaine, and it led to selling cocaine.
So did Mo go to prison herself?
Many times.
Yeah.
She was in and out of the prison system in British Columbia for the better part of a decade. She spent most of her 30s in and out of prison. She's been through a lot, and you'll hear about her personal story, but she got her life on track. And now she devotes her life to helping other women in that situation.
So what kind of practical things does she do for these women just getting out?
Well, to start with, when you're released from prison, you're usually wearing the clothes that you were arrested in.
Mm.
So she goes to help them get new clothes. She'll make sure that they're not homeless. When I was with her, she would get calls throughout the day from women who are still inside who wanted to have her come and meet them.
Andrea Crossan, thanks so much for the backstory. Let's now meet Mo Korchinski.
Hi. I'm just wondering about a ride to the Departure Bay Ferry on Sunday.
On Sunday the 25th?
Yeah.
Is there a reason why you can't take the public transportation? Because I'm not a taxi service, right? Like, we're a program?
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No problem. No, I'll take the bus.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye. A lot of them just want a ride quicker to get high and think that we're taxi services, but we're actually not a taxi service, we're a program. So
where was that woman?
The women's prison.
So she was calling you from prison to ask you for a lift?
Yes. Most of them are usually phoning looking for somewhere to go, because from our research we found that 85% in our provincial prison are homeless upon release. They're coming out with, you know, very few belongings in a clear plastic bag and a bus ticket back to where they were arrested from, right? And so a lot of the women don't want to go back to that, but there's very few places for women to go when they get released. We had a problem with one of the taxi drivers. Taxis used to pick up the women from the prison, and they used to get I remember getting propositioned by a taxi driver, you know, hey, give me a job and I'll give you some dope or I'll give you some money. And it actually happened to one of the girls. They actually propositioned her, gave her dope, and she OD'd and ended up in a coma. And so now the jail does not use the taxi service, because, you know, that was one of the most vulnerable times, is when you're picking them up from the jail. So actually now the jail actually has an officer who drives them up to the bus depot. No one wants to say, hey, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to be a drug addict and I'm going to be homeless on the street. I mean, there's a reason why somebody's numbing their whole feelings, because you don't have any feelings when, you know, you're totally numb when you're using. I remember when I tried, and that was one thing what attracted me to the drugs, was that it numbed all the hurt from my childhood abuse.
At what point did drugs become a key part of your life?
Drugs, well, my drug of choice was alcohol, and that was when I was 12 years old. And then I stayed as an alcoholic, you know, functioned, got married, had children as an alcoholic. And then the night my mom died of cancer, I picked up the cocaine, and it was like love at first sight. You know, I thought alcohol numbs your feelings, but no, cocaine is definitely numbs you.
How long was cocaine numbing you?
About 7 years, but as soon as I got into the cocaine, I ended up in jail, right? I sold cocaine to support my habit. I mean, you got to do something to support your habit. I mean, having a drug habit is not cheap.
You know, that's how people end up going in jail. So they're trying to support their drug habit. It's petty crimes or selling drugs or shoplifting, or it's all about trying to find, you know, a ways to support that drug habit. You know, I say if we deal with the addiction, we'll deal with the crime, and they won't end up back in jail. We don't look at the reason why somebody goes to jail. We just add more problems to people when they go to jail.
How many times were you incarcerated?
I was in and out for, I think I did four fairly long sentences. I did a year, 11 months, 15 months, and then 18 months sentence. So I did a fairly long bit.
How old were your kids the first time you went in?
Before I went to jail, I already walked away from my children, and I left my kids with their fathers. I just never went back. And I always thought my kids were better off without me anyways. And I still say my children were better off with their fathers. They had loving fathers, grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles. And being around a mother who didn't even know how to love herself, no longer loving another person, I still think they were better off. Everybody on the street is somebody's child or somebody's parent. The main thing what our peer mentors and our program can offer women coming out of prison is hope. Because everybody needs hope. Everybody needs a purpose. It's part of who we are as human beings. If you don't have either, what do you have? You're just existing. And we can't just exist. We have to have a purpose.
It's been a long time since you were in prison, but you still see people, you still help people who were in when you were in.
Oh, definitely. I still see, it's interesting because they'll call and I go, really? Aren't you sick of this lifestyle yet?
What did it for you?
For me was, I turned 40 in jail, and, I don't know if it was that milestone of turning 40, and, my jail sentences were long, and I got to form relationships with the staff and, recreational therapists. I had an amazing Aboriginal elder who loved us no matter what and was very non-judgmental, and so when it came to an opportunity for me to go to treatment, I didn't want to let them down. They believed so much in me. They seen good in me what no one's ever seen good in me before, and I just didn't want to let them down. And that's what I like to do with the women what I work with, is believe in them, because everybody needs somebody to believe in them.
Words of wisdom from Mo Korchinski, a peer mentor for women getting out of prison in Vancouver, Canada. She spoke with The World's Andrea Crossan for our series Unequal Justice. Tomorrow we'll hear about one key to staying out of prison, getting a good job. And that's what women get when they graduate from a drug program in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Sometimes I'll have flashbacks of my past. I never want to go back to where I can never pay rent again.
That's tomorrow here on the radio. All the stories in our series are online at PRI.org and on our Across Women's Lives Facebook page. Just look for Across Women's Lives. Freed prisoners struggling to rebuild a life. It's part of this next story, too. I'm speaking of some of the so-called Chibok girls, girls who committed no crime. The young women were kidnapped by Boko Haram militants from their boarding school in northern Nigeria. And as you'll recall, it inspired the hashtag campaign Bring Back Our Girls a few years ago. 4 years later, many of those Chibok students are still missing. But more than 100 are free, most of them young women now in their 20s. New York Times correspondent Dion Searcy and photographer Adam Ferguson investigated what's become of them since their release. They produced an interactive report for the Times. Searcy met with the women on the campus of a private Nigerian university where the young women are taking classes apart from the other students to catch up on their education.
It's a highly structured everyday life, actually. They have a lot of activities, but not a lot of downtime. They go to yoga, they have movie nights, they have debate night. I went to a debate night where they were arguing over the benefits and dangers of social media.
These young women, they were born in pretty poor, remote parts of Nigeria. Not the kind of setting where they expected to continue their education, I imagine.
That's right. I mean, not only is it a transition from their awful setting in the forest with Boko Haram, where some were beaten, where, some of them we think were killed. We're not sure, though. But it's quite a transition from their normal life. They were in a very poor village in a school where pretty much everyone agrees wasn't a highly performing academic environment for them. They were supposed to have been taught English in that school, and they were, but most of their English skills aren't very good, so they speak their local languages.
And yet they're taking classes in social media literacy. Is it all too much for them right now?
You know, I think most of them seem very, very happy. But the thing that I wondered about when I was there is a lot of their counseling sessions are in English. I mean, it's an English immersion program, so I understand. English is the main language in Nigeria. I mean, they're preparing them for college life. But they felt so much more free during their church service when I saw them. And that's translated into Hausa. And they're speaking, you know, their local language there.
So the psychologist you interviewed remarked that these women have seen hell together. What is the kind of nature of the counseling they're getting and how much has that helped?
They have regular therapy sessions and assessments, and they're together. And I think that they learn a lot from each other. There's also a set of women there who were part of the students who were kidnapped, but they escaped within the few hours, first few hours. And those women are really mentors to the other young women who were with Boko Haram for 3 years. And so I think that really helps them. And some of those women have transitioned already into the university. So they have this excellent example where they look up to and can see what could become of them.
So how sealed away are these young women from the rest of the students at the university?
They do live in their own dormitory. They take their classes, you know, it's just them in their classes, but it's side by side with other university classes. They go to the library. They are being transitioned to taking their meals in the cafeteria. Initially, when they went, they drew a lot of stares from the other students who frankly were scared of having these women who had spent so much time with militants there. And, you know, everyone knows some of these women even had babies with militants. I mean, they were raped by militants, but they have their children, and there's a huge stigma against anyone who spent time with Boko Haram.
Is the government worried that because of these previous ties to Boko Haram, there are larger fears?
There's a huge worry that, you know, Boko Haram would try to attack this school, right? I mean, it's Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. I mean, you can't get more Western than the education at an American university of Nigeria, right? And so they're worried Boko Haram will attack them. They're high-profile targets. They're celebrities, you know, in some respects. And so there's a lot of fear that these women will leave campus and something bad will happen to them, or that, you know, bad things will happen to the university. There's heavy security around the university.
Dion, I'm wondering if you can just tell us about one of the young women you met who might be making some progress in her struggle to come to grips with this trauma she went through.
The women are quite happy together. I mean, you can tell they enjoy being around each other and that they're quite close. I mean, they find each other's hands very easily. They hold hands. They hug each other a lot and put their arms around each other and put their arms around me. And, you know, they seem very, very resolute. All of them wanted to return to their home village of Chibok to make it better. I mean, they had plans to be an obstetrician or a lawyer. They were really, really intent on the fact that they wanted to make their hometown better.
So the interactive feature that goes with your time story is pretty extraordinary. Your colleague photographer Adam Ferguson took the portraits and a few slow motion video portraits of the women. What did you discuss about the portrayal?
The world knew these women from this awful video that Boko Haram put out a few weeks after they were captured. They were in dark gowns and sad faces and looked terrified. And that's the only image, you know, that the world had of these women, or these, back then they were girls, you know, for so long. And that's really how the world knew these women. And so our idea was to take individual portraits of them, to show them as individuals and just show who they are. I mean, in many ways, they are regular 20-somethings.
Right. Do you think at some point any of them will step out and just tell their own story?
Absolutely. I mean, they should tell their own stories. They're taking, the university is having them take public speaking classes and debate night and really prepping them. And part of that is just to give them confidence. But I think part of that is to enable them to have the skills to tell their own stories if they want to.
New York Times correspondent Dion Searcy. Dion, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
The Times photographed dozens of the young women from Chibok for that story. Dignified, noble, respectful. See for yourself. We have a link to the story at the World's Facebook page. 9 centimeters, that is about 3.5 inches. It doesn't sound like much, but doctors in Britain are pretty excited about it. It is a homegrown human jaw. That's correct. Surgeons at Nottingham University Hospital in England say they've managed to grow a human jaw about 9 centimeters long using a patient's own skin and bone tissue. The patient is a woman in her 50s named Val, who lost most of her jaw and lower face to cancer a couple of years ago.
She had had reconstructive surgery twice, which is the standard way of doing it, where you take bone from another part of the body and join it to blood vessels in the neck. Unfortunately, it failed both the times.
That's Dilip Srinivasan, one of the surgeons who worked on Val's case. He says those failed surgeries left her unable to talk and unable to eat. She had to be fed through a tube in her stomach. So the doctors had to try something different.
There's been a well-known technique called distraction osteogenesis, which essentially is when you make a cut in the bone and you slowly stretch the bone elongates.
It's a technique usually used to lengthen leg bones pretty much in a straight line.
And so we used that technique for a while to grow the jaw. However, because the jaw is a complex shape, we can't just stretch the bone. We also have to make sure the jaw grows to the right shape. So for that, we used a frame that will guide the regrowing bone to the right shape of the jaw. And that's what we did.
He kind of makes it sound like it's no big deal, but that's precisely what the doctors in Nottingham say is new here. Using this method to grow a complete jawbone, bends and all, for a patient who is also missing skin and jaw muscles. Dr. Srinivasan says he's confident Val will eventually be able to eat and talk as normal.
Absolutely. I mean, we have grown all the bone that we need to grow, not only the bone, as well as the skin. All we are waiting for now is the bone to gain some strength before we can do the final thing of joining things together.
Dilip Srinivasan, a surgeon at Nottingham University Hospital in England. Val's next surgery to remove the frame could happen as early as next month. Okay, shifting gears now. Until a few years ago, dog racing was legal here in Massachusetts, and it still is in some places.
Away we go, racing up towards the first bend, and away fast is Larry Mover.
The popularity of greyhound racing has dropped, though, as concerns have gone up about the dog's welfare and treatment. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez recently traveled to Tijuana, Mexico, with a rescue group that helps dogs at a racetrack there. But some worry that the rescuers may also be helping to keep the dog racing industry alive.
I just gotta get this trailer finished, hooked up.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and in the driveway of his Southern California home, Tom McCrory is attaching a trailer to his SUV and getting ready to drive south.
What are we about to do?
We're going to Tijuana to pick up 23 greyhounds.
That's 23 greyhound racing dogs who've been living and competing at Tijuana's Caliente racetrack. Tom and his wife, Joyce, are the founders of Fast Friends, a nonprofit that takes greyhounds reaching the end of their racing lives in Mexico and finds them new homes in the U.S. with people wanting to adopt them.
Some weekends we've done over 100 dogs out of there.
The couple say they've rescued at least 4,000 greyhounds in Tijuana since starting this work 30 years ago. If the dogs weren't adopted, Tom says, their fate would be bleak.
They would all wind up being euthanized. As soon as they become an unwanted animal, everybody knows what happens to all unwanted animals. If they don't get adopted, they get put down.
About 2 hours after setting off, Tom and I reached the racetrack in Tijuana. Manuel Perez takes care of the dogs at the track. He walks me over to the kennel filled with greyhounds we're taking back to the U.S. The sleek and elegant dogs wear muzzles and swarm around me in a very friendly greeting. Manuel says he grows attached to the dogs and is sorry to see them leave.
Es un orgullo que vengan por ellos para que los den en adopción en Estados Unidos.
But he says he's glad they're being taken to homes in the U.S.
Muy mal económicamente.
In a poor country like Mexico, Manuel says, dog adoption isn't common. After we talk, Manuel and his team quickly load the greyhounds aboard Tom's kennel trailer. And then it's back to California after clearing customs.
And are the dogs pretty good being in the mobile kennel?
Yeah. Yeah. They get transported this way a lot. You know, they go from track to track and they get transported in vehicles like this.
Some animal rights organizations criticize Fast Friends for collaborating with the racetrack in Tijuana. They say it perpetuates an industry that exploits and sometimes abuses the greyhounds. In the U.S., 41 states have banned dog racing. But Tom pushes back at his critics, arguing that as long as racing exists, there are two options for the dogs: adoption or death when they're done with racing, typically at age 5.
Once you meet a greyhound, these are such magnificent animals. How can you sit on the sidelines and do nothing? I can't let that dog be put down.
When we get back to Tom's house, the greyhounds are unloaded and volunteers take over. The dogs are led to a big enclosed space, checked out medically and cleaned, including dipping their feet in an anti-tick solution.
If it's wet for a minute, yeah! That's not bad.
Good boy, Sam.
They're amazing dogs. And just to see them, like, come off the track. And there's like an alien world to them.
Brittany Petty is a volunteer with Fast Friends. She says it's amazing how quickly the greyhounds transition from being racetrack competitors to loving pets and companions.
They literally transform. It's like a metamorphosis. And you get to see them, like, just change into a pet.
And do it pretty quickly?
They do. The good thing about them is they're used to, like, routine. And if you're consistent and keep a routine with them, they learn so fast.
Let me see your face. Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
yes,
my gosh,
what a face.
That's Joyce McCrory, co-founder of Fast Friends. She says devoting her life to so many dogs for so long has brought joys and burdens.
I have to be honest, though. Sometimes I'm thinking, what the heck have I done? You know, but then there are days like this, and there are more of these.
Joyce then motions to the greyhounds around us, gently nuzzling up against people. After staying with foster families, most of the dogs transported from Tijuana will be placed in permanent new homes within a month, their days of competition and racing behind them for good. For the World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
And I'm wondering if any of you have adopted a Tijuana greyhound. If you did, hey, this is what the internet is for. Please send us a snap of your pooch and tag it Global Greyhound. We'd love to see a whole litter on our Twitter feed. So tweet us your adopted greyhound pictures at PRI The World. That's all. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.